Hello, I am Michael Tran from HSF's Head Office Advisory Team, and welcome to Reporting for Duties. Reporting for Duties is our limited podcast series aiming to provide bite-sized insights on corporate reporting and ESG. In this episode, we have Tim Stutt, Anna Caronio, and Susanna Houston reporting for duty, and our topic for discussion is the current status of assurance under the climate reporting regime. Before we get into it, though, I'd first like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from which we are broadcasting today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders both past and present. To start off, Susanna, can you please explain where things are at in relation to assurance under the regime?
I can give it a go, Michael. Initially, Treasury had flagged limited assurance of scope 1 and 2 emissions from the commencement of the regime with reasonable assurance over all disclosures by 2030, but it wasn't entirely clear how we got from one to the other. And actually, as a foundational point, I think I should just flag that reasonable assurance is where the auditor expresses an opinion as to whether information disclosed complies with the reporting requirements, whereas limited assurance is a bit less burdensome, where the auditor reports on whether anything has come to their attention that causes them to believe the information disclosed does not comply with the reporting requirements. So it's in the negative. And that means that the procedures performed by the auditor for limited assurance would be narrower in scope than they would be required for reasonable assurance. So that's where we were at. And then on the 20th of March, the Auditing and Assurance Standards Board released its consultation paper, which said that they intended to develop assurance standards in line with the IAASB, so that the International's final standards over sustainability information, and that they may also provide supplementary standards for an Australian context. So as part of this consultation paper, they've provided a possible phasing model, but they did preface that it's only presented to facilitate feedback on the likely demand for assurance and the ability of auditors and experts to meet that likely demand. So we cannot take it as verbatim. But as a general sense, they indicated that from the first year of reporting, it would be limited assurance of scope 1 and 2 emissions that would be required. So that was consistent with Treasury's initial position. And then it builds from there. So the next year would see reasonable assurance of scope 1 and 2 emissions and all governance disclosures. And the consultation paper spotlights governance in saying it could be subject to reasonable assurance earlier because governance is important to climate-related matters, the subject of disclosure, and the work required to uplift between limited and reasonable assurance might not be significantly different. And in that second year of reporting, there would also be limited assurance of all other required disclosures. And that would remain the state of play until around the 30th of June 2027. This was before the timeline was pushed out. So it might actually be the 1st of January 2028. And then from that point on, reasonable assurance over all required disclosures would need to occur up until 2030. And that's as far as the proposed phasing model goes.
Thanks, Susanna. Now, Tim and Anna, what are you both seeing in practice with respect to getting ready for assurance under the regime?
Thanks, Michael. We do have another podcast which talks about gap analysis, so I won't go into it in too much detail, but I just wanted to point out that as part of that exercise, we're starting to see a bit of mapping out of what sort of documents could be used to assist with the assurance process. And I think it's actually quite helpful to keep those documents in mind in preparing reports and disclosures because it'll make the task a lot easier later, particularly for the auditor. We're also seeing a focus on sort of developing systems and processes and, again, keeping in mind what documents could be used to substantiate the disclosures as part of that. The sort of documents we might see in some cases will be typical governance documents such as board papers, board minutes, management papers and management committee meeting notes, those sorts of things. Board and committee charters, etc. But there will be a range of much more detailed documents that will be needed to assist with the assurance process as well.
I think in some respects, while governance has been called out as one of the areas to move to reasonable assurance quite early, so sort of this second year of the regime, actually that will require a bit of paddling on the part of companies, in that the governance processes, they may be very well articulated in some areas, such as consideration of climate-related risks, but actually in other areas they might be not documented to the same level. So, for instance, consideration of climate-related opportunities, that's an area where often companies haven't necessarily had it in a structured framework in the way that their risk management occurs. And that's an area where there might be a bit more work required. How does the board oversee climate-related opportunities? How do they get funneled up to the board? There are some areas like that where the documentation may be a bit looser, and the process of sort of bringing it together and articulating it will require a bit of work on the part of companies. I think the focus in the Australian sustainability reporting standards on how things occur and how processes are followed has meant that there is a bit of a lack of clarity as to what sorts of documents will tick off on different requirements. Where it's something where it relates to scope one or scope two data, it's sort of clearer as to what information is needed and how to check it. Where it's how a process is done in practice, the documents you might point to substantiate that are probably a little bit less clear. And certainly for clients which are doing some of this assurance already, the feedback that we're getting is often the auditors don't quite know what sort of documents might best tick off on the requirements, and the companies don't know what sort of documents might best tick off on the requirements. So we sort of do expect that the gap analysis exercise that Anna's talking about may sit alongside the documentation and articulating the processes and channeling some of the what happens in practice to be what happens on the page as well. So they do sort of sit alongside. That obviously creates a bit of a tension point, in that if you're talking about particular processes, they need to be lived in practice, and there will be risk there if you're not describing it in a way that is accurate and not able to substantiate what's being said. So, you know, in that sense, it does make sense that it all sort of gets developed together at the same time.
This is definitely an area that I think you can get started on sooner than later as well, sort of mapping the governance arrangements and the information flows between board, management committees, et cetera, is definitely something you can do in advance to try and figure out, well, how would we actually demonstrate this?
I do think as well where the legislation has landed with respect to the director's declaration, it sort of neatly reinforces this. So for the first 3 years, the director's declaration is that the company has taken reasonable steps to comply with the Corporations Act and the sustainability reporting standard. So it's not to the level of the director's affirming compliance with, but it's that the company has taken reasonable steps. And that sort of goes to the fact that during that first three years, the company will still be refining its disclosures and trying to understand what its processes are and describe them to the market through the reporting. And that's also occurring at a time where we don't yet have full auditing of all of the reporting either. So In that respect, the directors would have otherwise been in a very uncomfortable position of having to affirm compliance with the requirements when they didn't necessarily have the comfort of auditing being run in tandem to help substantiate and find problems and so on and so forth. Clearly, auditing doesn't detract from directors' own non-delegable duties in respect of approving the reporting. We've seen that through case law, but in practice, the directors often do derive a fair amount of comfort from knowing that the auditing process is running alongside their review and funneling up as part of their consideration of the annual reporting suite. So in that respect, the fact that the directors don't have to give an unqualified statement of compliance from day one of this regime is a welcome development.
The other thing that I probably need to mention now is the V word that everyone dreads, verification. So to the extent that we do have limited assurance of things to give directors comfort, I think verification will be the other piece of the puzzle. And sort of the document trail that we've been talking about does feed into verification as well. And we do have a separate podcast that we've recorded about that.
Thank you all for providing that overview of the current status of insurance under the regime. And thank you for joining us. This was Tim Stutt, Anna Caronio, Susanna Hewson, and Michael Tran reporting for Judy.
You have been listening to a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. For more episodes, please go to our channel on iTunes, Spotify, or SoundCloud. And visit our website, herbertsmithfreehills.com, for more insights relevant to your business.